Hi, you're listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.
Thank you so much for being here. I know it's hot and I really am very grateful that you're here with us. This is an absolute honour and a privilege for me to be standing here speaking in memory of John Smith. I can't tell you how honoured I am to be here. But before I'm just going to do a wee bit of introduction, and then we have a special guest for you who you've seen already. But I want to say some words of thanks in my introduction before we really get going. I just want to say thank you to this festival because this festival has really, really shaped my life in a way that is profoundly deep. It's to do with emotions, it's to do with spirituality, it's to do with worship, it's to do with giving and living and creativity. And I think sometimes it's possible to forget that, the profound influence that this festival has had on so many people's lives. This rich and diverse space that we all come back to each year. Some of my oldest friendships have been forged at this festival. My earliest artistic forays into creativity happened here at Greenbelt. Some of you, I think at least two of you might remember, there was a band that I used to play in a long time ago in the mid-80s called Sublime. Thank you. If you see me afterwards, I'll give you a book or something. When I had hair with my brother, and all the way up to doing stuff on the literature venue, curating that in the 90s, and then recently curating more literature and reading and workshopping there too. It's also, this festival is responsible for my marriage to Tati, which is a really, really long story. I won't tell you it here. But, you know, this is profound stuff. This is really, really profound stuff. And I want to place what I'm going to say shortly about John Smith in the context of those big, big life-changing moments. So I owe Greenbelt more than I can say, and it is just such an honour to be here. And I want to start by saying thank you to Greenbelt. And I also want to say thank you to Paul Northup. I don't think he's here, but Paul is the creative director of Greenbelt, and he invited me to do this talk. And the nearer it's come to standing here in front of you, the more nervous I've become, not because I'm nervous of you, but I'm daunted by the late and great example of John Smith, because he wasn't actually a daunting man. I only met him once, and I'll say more about this later on. I only met John once, and in the moment I met him, he was actually in quite a shy moment. So I'm not daunted by him personally, but by his example, his integrity as a human being, his activism, the way he led his life, what he said, and the way that tied in with how he lived his life was so of a piece that that is what's daunting. So I'm conscious that there are many people here who knew John directly, and we're going to hear some of those voices later. We're deliberately making some space to hear those voices towards the end of the talk. So a bit of signposting before we begin. I'm going to speak for about 30, 35 minutes about John and his work primarily here at Greenbelt. There are other voices that are going to come in and say other and fill you in about other aspects of John's life, people who knew him one-to-one. And then we're also going to open up for reminiscences from other folk who have also arrived here this afternoon. But before that, I want to welcome a special guest who will be well known to you all. Martin Joseph is a very, very good friend of this festival. He knew John very, very well, and he's going to celebrate John's life in words and in song. So please give a warm Greenbelt welcome to Martin Joseph.
Thanks, Tony, very much. Hi, everybody. This gets too slick and professional, let me know. I'll tone it down a little bit. There you go. John and I, our worlds collided in around 1986. Our worlds collided and he sent me off in a completely different direction. In many ways, he changed my music. He changed so much of my thinking. He had this beautiful way of contextualizing a spirituality that was understandable and real, and it's something that's hard to articulate. And good luck, Tony, in doing that. I'm sure you'll do a great job. But he was an absolute mess at times. He was a great friend. I was driving home from the Shrewsbury Folk Festival where I played a set last night coming back to Greenbelt, and I was trying to have some sort of conversation with him to ask what he'd like me to play. and the list was endless in so many ways. I figured he... I always thought, you know, you get that asked that question, if who would you like to have round to dinner? You know, three or four people. And my list was Bruce Springsteen, John Smith, Billy Connolly, and an American female singer and songwriter called Annie DeFranco. So that's where I put him. He was right up there, and I miss him greatly. But there's a huge legacy in his wake. So I decided I was going to sing this. Man walking down a railroad track, he's going someplace and there's no going back. Highway patrol chopper coming up over the ridge, hot soup on a campfire under the bridge. Shelter line stretches around the corner. Welcome to the New World Order. Families sleeping in the cars in the Midwest, with no home, no job, no peace, no rest. The highway is alive tonight. Ain't nobody kidding nobody about where it goes. Sitting down here in the campfire light, waiting on the ghost of old Tom Joe. He takes a prayer book out of his sleeping bag. The preacher lights up a bud and takes a drag. Waiting for the first, last shall be first, and the first shall be last. In the cardboard box neath the underpass, you got a one-way ticket to the promised land. Got a hole in your belly and a gun in your hand. Sleeping on a pillow of solid rock. Bathing in the city's aqueduct. The highway is alive tonight. Ain't nobody kidding nobody about where it goes. Sitting down here in this campfire light, waiting on the ghost of old Tom Joad. Tom says, Ma, wherever there's a cop beating on a guy, where a hungry newborn baby cries, with a fight against the blood and hatred in the air, well, just look for me, Ma, I'll be there. If somebody's fighting for a place to stand, or a decent job and a helping hand, if there's someone struggling to be free, just look in their eyes, Ma, you'll see me. And the highway is alive tonight. Ain't nobody kidding nobody about where it goes. all sitting down here in this Greenbelt tent. My sweet brothers and sisters, we're with the ghost of old John Smith. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Martin. That is absolutely fantastic. That is just the best way to start this celebration of John's life. And what I think that does also is reconnect us to that that place of grief and of prophetic utterance, which in that amazing song. We hear that voice coming through. So thank you again. That was just brilliant. Brilliant way to start. Thank you. So a few words of context before I really get into the meat of what I'm going to say. Paul Northrop, as I said, invited me to do this talk on the basis of a blog post that I wrote in March earlier this year, learning that John had died. There is a short extract from that in the program. You might have seen it. But I'd like to read you the whole thing because it gives you a bit of context about why I'm here and still find myself returning each year to this amazing sacred space. And the blog post took the form of a letter and I published it on Good Friday. So here it is. Dear John Smith, I was deeply saddened to hear that you died earlier this year in March. I'm told that you had prostate cancer. I'm so sorry that you had to go through that. Though you don't need me to tell you, my reason for writing is to reassure you that what you did, how you spoke and lived your life, was not in vain. The first time I heard you speak must have been in the mid to late 80s at Greenbelt. I still have the tapes somewhere. One day I'm going to digitize them so I can listen to you all over again. But in a way, I don't need to. Your passion, learning and prophetic imagination are with me all the time. I hadn't, still haven't, now I think about it, heard anything like it. At the end of the festival, we used to buy cassette copies of your talks to take home to the suburbs. Listening to you on that format, as we had to in those days, meant that we hung on every word, no fast forwarding or back with an indolent swipe of the finger to get to another passage. As with that box of cassettes, I still have the notebooks. You might even say that my sheltered, conservative church upbringing had predisposed me to one of two reactions to your talks, dismissing you as unbiblical, which I think you wore as a badge of honor when engaging in fundamentalist circles, or a kind of grateful shock that was pleasing as it was painful as I witnessed my naive, long-held, and unexamined assumptions about everything, gender, race, injustice, the environment, economic power structures, fall away. You were also the first Christian speaker I had heard talking about depression without resorting to the language of demonization. I was always grateful to you for that. The talk of yours I still go back to is your riff on what you planned to ask God when you got to heaven. After the formalities, you said you wanted answers to two questions. Why, you would demand to know, had God allowed the Bible to be used as a tool for such historic oppression to both women and minoritized ethnic groups? And why, when he heard that John the Baptist was banged up in jail, didn't Jesus bust him out of there? It occurs to me now that you might finally have been granted your wish. You were the first speaker in my hearing who opened up and explained, not rationalized, how prophetic notions of wilderness, disillusionment, pain, suffering, failure, and disappointment are critical to understanding the true calling of the church as you saw it. To borrow a line I know you were fond of using throughout your whole career, though I've been searching since then to hear someone else with the same ache in their voice, I still haven't found what I'm looking for. as a poet once said in a very different context, you went right in there and began opening windows. As another poet said, you made us realise what we had been putting up with in the meantime. Happy Good Friday, John. Keep a seat for me at your next seminar. With good wishes and eternal thanks, Anthony. So hopefully that gives you a glimpse of where I'm coming from today as I speak about the influence and implications of John's teaching, which I believe to be as relevant as ever. I'm going to be picking up on a few remarks that Steve Shaw made in the first of these John Peck Memorial Lectures 2 years ago, which I think are pertinent to a discussion of John Smith's work. And then I'm going to try and frame John's teaching through the lens of what the Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann calls the prophetic imagination. And through this framing, I'm going to look at a few of John's key themes and concerns from his years as a speaker at Greenbelt and explore why they still resonate today. So firstly, I want to reiterate some of the things that Steve Shaw said in the first John Peck lecture a couple of years ago. The first is to emphasize how important it is for us to examine the way that we think, not just the beliefs and the values that we hold. I work in teacher and medical education in Exeter at the university there. And we talk especially early on in our course, about a Russian philosopher and psychologist who some of you I know will know, called Lev Vygotsky. He died in the 1930s. And what his work examines and opens up and presupposes that learning is social. Learning is social and always contextualized. And the other major quote that I use at the beginning of my academic year, which is coming around quite soon with my students, is to talk about students, so that might mean children, it might mean adults, it might mean in a sort of family context or a church context, but learners, in whatever context they're in, always grow into what he calls the intellectual life of those around them. So that might be through a teacher, it might be through a sibling, it might be through, you know, someone in church, it might be in a variety of contexts. And as Steve said a couple of years ago, and as John Smith frequently pointed out, we are always shaped by someone or something. We are not empty vessels or blank slates. We are products of a culture, and it is beholden upon us to speak to and engage with the culture that we belong to. And just as an aside, if you haven't looked at it yet, I've been listening to it on audiobook recently. Steve Chalk, who I know speaks at Greenbelt, he has a wonderful new book called The Lost Message of Paul, where he unpacks Paul's theology and worldview as a second temple Jew. And that's a really, really good example of what I'm talking about. If you haven't checked that out, it's really worth checking out. So who and what shaped John Smith? First and fundamentally, as you already know, John's mind was absolutely soaked in the language of the Old and New Testaments. As Walter Brueggemann puts it in his book, The Practice of Prophetic Imagination, the prophetic proclamation that John was engaging in and specialized in was an attempt to imagine the world as though Yahweh, whom we Christians come to name as Father, Son, and Spirit, as though Yahweh were a real character and an effective agent in the world. And every syllable that John uttered, looked for, hoped for, argued, and waited for God's agentive action in our beautiful and broken creation. He was alive, as theologians tend to call it, to the now and the not yet. So to the here and now of God's kingdom, which has arrived and is here, but and the not yet of Jesus' return. The now of Donald Trump and racial hatred, and the not yet of justice once again rising in our politics. And I think that is why he was constantly quoting the U2 line that I've already used, I still haven't found what I'm looking for. Parallel to, but not at the expense of that, John was also deeply rooted in the language and workings of popular culture. He would quote and refer to everything from his beloved U2 to Bruce Springsteen, who we've already heard from via Martin and Queen, from Tina Turner and Whitney Houston to theoreticians like Susan Brown Miller and the psychologist Viktor Frankl. Alongside theology, he was conversant with history, economics, science, gender politics, and film, and more. Listening to John Smith reminds me of what I imagine it must have been like to listen to St. Paul debating with the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers in the Areopagus in Athens. This is in Acts 17. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "People of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship, and this is what I'm going to proclaim to you." And the rest of the chapter is him basically having this full-on debate with the elite philosophers and scholars of Athens of that time. So like St. Paul, John began where people were. He engaged with them, immersing himself in the culture of, quote-unquote, the other, without dismissal or rejection or threat or fear of threat. He engaged critically, but was not without criticism. As Steve Shaw said, again in his opening lecture about John Peck, quoting John Peck, he said, I start with Christ, but from that moment on, I am open to everything. That's a quote from John Peck himself. And I think that is where John was coming from too. I'm going to speak personally now. As a poet, I long in the pit of my being to hear a sermon which begins in the way that St. Paul does in the Areopagus in Acts chapter 17. I was walking around your city and I noticed what some of your poets have written. Imagine walking into church and the speaker opening with a few lines with some lines by Marie Howe from the States or Maya Angelou or Elizabeth Bishop. I still live in hope of this. As those of you who've heard John speak many times will know, he was fond of calling the arts the nerve ends of the soul. Being here in the warm embrace of Greenbelt, I should say the ultra-hot embrace of Greenbelt, it's hard to imagine this. But so often in the contemporary church, we seem to treat popular culture, and in particular the arts, at best with suspicion and at worst with outright hostility, because we are bought into the dominant utilitarian and enlightenment mindset of our culture, mistaking it for common sense. And it grieves me deeply that I still need to say that in 2019, even though I stand here at Greenbelt and say it. As a fledgling poet, I remember an old preacher explaining to me once how radical Paul's behavior was for its time. A Jew engaging with non-Jews, using as a basis for discussion, again, quote-unquote, non-sacred texts by the other and in a non-sacred space. The kind of God who saw this as good was the kind of God I wanted to believe in, but whom I so seldom found in sermons, which tended to emphasize binary positions of right versus wrong, us versus them, and in versus out. John's talks remind us that there is no substitute for loving your own culture deeply, to the extent that you can spot where it has resonances with the gospel. By the same token, re-listening to John's talks this year on the Greenbelt website and from various tapes that people have sent in, it's been a re-education in the art of the put-down. I lost count of the times John took to task the beliefs, practices, and language of some minority world mega church cultures, in particular what he called the heresy of prosperity doctrine. How he sustained the energy to keep attacking the excesses of that culture as he saw it is an object lesson in sticking close to your principles even when it hurts. In one of his talks, he refers to spending half a night rereading the Book of Amos just to make sure he was not superimposing his own views above those of Scripture. And the danger of prophetic practice like this is that it's easy to become misunderstood both by those inside and outside of the church. Part of the problem with this, so brilliantly opened up by Steve Shaw a couple of years ago, is that we've given too much credence to the rational mind and not enough to that which credits marvels. That's a phrase from Seamus Heaney. As Walter Brueggemann says in Finally Comes the Poet, which is another marvelous book, our technical way of thinking reduces mystery to problem. It transforms assurance into certitude, revises quality into quantity, and so takes the categories of biblical faith and represents them in manageable shapes. And it's to Greenbelt's eternal credit, that it gave space to an unpredictable speaker like John and a home for him. So this leads me on to what Walter Brueggemann calls the prophetic imagination. What does that mean? And I just want to say that This is heavily biased. This is my interpretation. And I understand that there will be people here who would have a different interpretation. But this is how I am seeing it. So Walter Brueggemann has a lovely phrase, again, in his book, Finally Comes the Poet. I'm changing his language slightly because John was Australian and not American. He says this: he used language that moved like a Dennis Lilly bouncer, that jumps at the right moment, that breaks open old worlds with surprise, abrasion, and pace. Surprise, abrasion, and pace. I think that is John to an absolute T. I take prophetic imagination to mean these two things: the calling out of evil, injustice, and religious practice that is inconsistent with God's word, and a calling into being, an encouragement of things as they might be otherwise, and thereby a calling into being of hope. John's words were packed with courage, freedom, and daring, nothing less than the voice, the work of voicing and enacting the world anew according to the holiness of God. And as I've said, his preaching style could be abrasive, but what I've loved re-listening to his talks this year is that, having put people's backs up in one talk or trodden on personal sensitivities, he would listen to those around him who told him that he might have gone too far, and he would return the next day to apologize and reconfigure what he was trying to say in a more nuanced form. And I think that does take courage, not least for a man who was conscious, as I know John was, of the reputation that went before him. And how often — this is just a question I would like to offer — how often do we hear our church leaders, some of our church leaders, not all church leaders obviously, openly modeling that vulnerability and humility in the public sphere? He would frequently and unashamedly break down in tears mid-sentence as he found himself becoming overwhelmed by the story that he was telling. He went on long riffs, sometimes riffs within riffs of illustration that would leave your head spinning. He interpreted the Bible as though he was seeing a film of events that he was describing taking place in front of his eyes that no one else could see. He took us into the mindset of prophets, the prophets whose work he adored, but also of the religious and political elites whose work he was criticizing. There's a further aspect to the prophetic imagination, which I've already touched on, namely that it is costly. As I said at the beginning, I didn't know John personally. I only met him once. But my impression of re-listening to him this year is that it cost him personally to speak out in the way he did and to do the work that he did. And it cost — I think, I'm inferring here, but I sense that it cost the people around him as well. This is by a writer called Walter J. Houston, from a review of Walter Brueggemann's work. And he talked — this is all about loss. Loss must both be imagined as judgment and experienced as grief, ultimately leading to acceptance. Thus, the preacher's task is not complete in announcing judgment. The community's grief must also be articulated in solidarity. And beyond loss and grief, it is still the prophet's business to enact hope as the imagination of the impossible, of resurrection and restoration. So this links to — there's a great paper. It's quite a dense academic paper. There's a great paper. You can actually find it quite easily online, by a paper by Walter Brueggemann called The Costly Loss of Lament. And it's all about how we've lost that sense of grief and of loss in some of our church discourses. And John's argument, as I understand it, is that some of our praise and worship culture moves too readily into praise first without spending time in lament for the marginalized, for the hungry, for the ill, for our climate, for our politics, for our culture. And that in moving so quickly to praise, we misrepresent the biblical pattern laid down in the Psalms, and further, that we diminish ourselves as interlocutors with God. And we lose the opportunity for being transformed by a loving God as we articulate our pain. Brueggemann says this. In the words, he says this: as we lament, we shift the calculus and we redress the distribution of power between the two parties, between ourselves and between and God. And again, just as an aside, there's a really great book that's just come out by a theologian called David Runcorn. If any of you are interested in exploring this area a bit further, his name is David Runcorn, and the book is called The Language of Tears, and it's all about how we need to articulate and almost celebrate the language of loss and of grief within our church settings. So if you know prophetic people in your church or your work setting or wherever you might be, from my own experience, they're the ones who tend to see the complexity of these big issues that we're all affected by, like Brexit, like climate change, and so on. They tend to see those coming much, much earlier than the rest of us. They tend to read the bigger story of the news, the bit of the iceberg that lies below the surface of the water. They tend to see that stuff in much more sharp and close reality than the stuff that the rest of us are looking just from looking at the headlines. They might be people who are on the edge, literally on the edge. The people who are making art, maybe, or working with disadvantaged or marginalized groups. The people stuck in the corner talking to the folk that no one else is talking to. Or even maybe the people who leave early. They tend not to be the people who are always up front, although John was unusual in that he was up front a lot in all senses of that phrase. Prophets are people, as Brueggemann puts it, because of their roots in the theological tradition and because of some emancipatory experience in their own life. And they refuse to accept the definitions of reality that are imposed upon us by the socio-economic political power structure. I'm coming towards the end. I just need to rub my eyes because my sun cream is running into my eyes and stinging, so bear with me. So I'm going to say some themes that John spoke about, and then I'm going to finish with two poems, and then we're going to hand over to some people who've come to say some things as friends of John. John repeatedly returned to the following themes. As I said right at the beginning, he talked about the church's need to redefine its understanding of the desert and wilderness experience, about how you don't find yourself when you're comfortable, but when everything or everyone around you is going to pieces. He talked about the importance of finding heroes, both from within church culture and from without church culture, outside of church culture, that we can all identify with and believe in. He was particularly scathing about the false promises of prosperity doctrine teaching that encouraged its followers to, quote, find themselves and develop self-esteem at the expense of loving the marginalized and advocating for the poor. He spoke about disillusionment. This is the one impression of John I'm allowing myself in this talk as a warning. I can't hear John saying the word disillusionment. You know how we used to elongate those vowels? I just can't hear that word. I can't see it written down without hearing that voice in my head. He spoke about depression and about cancer. He adored and kept returning to the story of the prodigal son, placing it in its rightful context as a rebuke to the Pharisees for misunderstanding the loving nature and heart of God. He repeatedly turned to the theme of postmodernism, welcoming it as something that destroyed and destructed old modes of worship, while thinking of it as a warning about our human need for narratives and meta-narratives that we can all believe in and share in. He spoke about the need for biblical literacy as opposed to biblical literalism. And he repeatedly attacked the power structures of late capitalism, from the way in which we are all, from a very young age, taught to be consumers, to hegemonist discourses which seek to give tax breaks to the already rich while demonizing those who require vital state services as scroungers. Everything he said was shot through with his love of living, working, and being on the edge, not because he had some sort of white savior complex, but because he believed fundamentally we belong to each other. So I think John was an amazing human being. I think he was far from perfect, as we're going to hear in a minute. He was beautiful, humble, learned, wise, outrageous, and excitable. And we can count ourselves privileged to have been given a glimpse of what we are all still looking for. Thank you, Greenbelt, for giving John a home. We started with some art. I'm going to finish with two poems. And I thought it was just appropriate. I ran this by Paul Northup, and he said this would be a really good idea to do. You may be aware of the late and also great Australian poet Les Murray, who died just a few weeks after John died earlier this year. He was 80 when he died. And sadly, we never got him to Greenbelt. So in lieu of that, I'm going to read a poem of Les Murray to exemplify all the things that I've been talking about, which I think are visible in John's work. If you don't know the poem, I really urge you to go. You can find it online. It's very easy to find. The poem is called The Quality of Sprawl. I'm not going to do an Australian accent. The Quality of Sprawl. Sprawl is the quality of the man who cut down his Rolls-Royce into a farm utility truck. And sprawl is what the company lacked when it made repeated efforts to buy the vehicle back to repair its image. Sprawl is doing your farming by aeroplane, roughly, or driving a hitchhiker that extra 300 miles home. It is the rococo of being your own still center. It is never lighting cigars with $10 notes. That's idiot ostentation and murder of starving people. Nor can it be bought with the ash of million-dollar deeds. Sprawl lengthens the legs. It trains greyhounds on liver and beer. Sprawl almost never says, "Why not?" with palms comically raised. Nor can it be dressed for, not even in running shoes worn with mink and a nose ring. That is society. That's style. Sprawl is more like the 13th banana in a dozen, or anyway the 14th. Sprawl is Hank Stamper in Never Give an Inch, bisecting an obstructive official's desk with a chainsaw, not harming the official. Sprawl is never brutal, though it's often intransigent. Sprawl is never Simon de Montfort at a town storming, "Kill them all, God will know his own." Knowing the man's name who said this might said to be Sprawl. Sprawl occurs in art, the 15th to 21st lines in a sonnet, for example, and in certain paintings. I have sprawl enough to have forgotten which paintings. Turner's glorious The Burning of the Houses of Parliament comes to mind, a doubling bannered triumph of sprawl, except he didn't fire them. Sprawl gets up the noses of many kinds of people, all the kind that comes in kinds, whose futures don't include it. Some decry it as criminal presumption, silken-robed Pope Alexander dividing the New World between Spain and Portugal. If he smiled in petto afterwards, perhaps the thing did have sprawl. Sprawl is really classless, though. It's John Christopher Frederick Murray asleep in his neighbour's best bed in spurs and oilskins, but not having thrown up. Sprawl is never Callum, who drunk along the hallways of our house, reinvented the festoon. Rather, it's Beatrice Miles going 1,200 ditto in a taxi. No lewd advances, no hitting animals, no speeding. On the proceeds of her two Bob a Sonnet Shakespeare readings. An image of my country. And would that it were more so. No, sprawl is full gloss murals on a council house wall. Sprawl leans on things. It is loose-limbed in its mind. Reprimanded and dismissed. It listens with a grin and one boot up on the rail of possibility. It may have to leave the earth. Being roughly Christian, it scratches the other cheek and thinks it unlikely, though people have been shot for sprawl. Thank you for listening. So I'm going to invite some people to come up. We're going to start with Jim Stewart, who's going to say some words about the God Squad and so on. Off you go, Jim. Take care.
You got it now? Yep. Yep. Many of you know that John was the international president of God Squad, and that role has been taken over by Sean Stillman, who wanted to be here, but fortunately has had an operation brought forward. Sean starts with a message from John. "If you want to reject the claims of Jesus, then I want to make sure it is the Jesus of Nazareth of the Gospels you're rejecting and not a travesty of that. My sincere apologies, I cannot be here today to bring this tribute personally. Smithy loved Greenbelt. Greenbelt loved Smithy. Some of his most endearing and enduring friendships were nurtured at Greenbelt. Artists, writers, speakers, activists for justice, grassroots mission practitioners, and fellow dreamers were part of his tribe. which to some extent continues to exist as a bizarre network of misfits. Some of his most cutting-edge recorded messages were from Greenbelt, primarily due to a strict schedule that prevented him rattling on too long. But Greenbelt also sharpened his focus. He always wanted to give his very best here. When not on stage, he would be enthused by the conversations that would follow him around the site, none more so than those with fellow searchers who had questions and were of a mind to inquire, and would thrive on enthusing the weary and wounded with hope to keep going. Behind the scenes, there would always be a logistical nightmare of getting him to the right venue on time with everything he needed. There would always be someone needed to gather all the things he lost between the venues. His hat, Bible, bag, books, newspapers, laptop, tickets, wallet. It was often Heather Curnow who did a remarkable job. Greenbelt energised John, and that meant a lot to him and those that shared life with him either side of the festival. It was Steve Drury, his manager in the 80s, that recognised this perfect match of Greenbelt and this bizarre character, which embodied something of the prophet Jeremiah, Crocodile Dundee, John the Baptist, and Johnny Cash. We shouldn't be surprised at this precious connection with Greenbelt, for both John and Greenbelt grew up the Jesus movement, and John remained a Jesus-loving hippie that believed he could change the world until his very last breath. And for some of us, he did change our world. Greenbelt brought Smithy to the UK regularly, and that had significant spin-offs. He did dates on the road with myself and others, and that ultimately led to God Squad starting in the UK. Many years on, God Squad is a missional legacy of John's influence that is now active in over a dozen European countries, as well as in New Zealand and Australia, where it originated. It remains one of the most diversely mission movements, continuing in ministry among motorcycle clubs and other marginalised communities, from here in the UK as far east as Finland and Ukraine and many points in between. Smithy's legacy also extends to many grassroots mission initiatives that have been that have an edge to them that they would not have if we had not been exposed to John's passionate exposition of the kingdom of God. This is certainly my experience of what has developed both within God Squad at Zach's Place and other connected initiatives globally. There will be countless mission pioneers and activists for justice in far-flung corners of the planet who are there doing what they do because of the prophetic call to action that John passionately declared without compromise for so many years at Greenbelt. He was the voice we needed to hear at that time. I wondered what John would want to say to Greenbelt today. His last published essay drew a parallel with his own experience of the growth of his own cancer cells in the church. He said this, "For the church, as for cancer, the key question is not how fast you're growing, but what you're growing." He'd still challenge us not to lose our focus, to be growing and maturing in the right kind of stuff, to still be countercultural, to take the Sermon on the Mount seriously, to rise to calls for justice, mercy, and humility from the prophets. He'd still ask questions like, what if Jesus really meant this stuff, like loving your enemies? He'd still challenge us to act differently. I would like to thank Greenbelt for giving John the platform to enthuse about Jesus, the Jesus he followed, and for honouring him in this way today. It will mean a lot to his family and to those others of us that loved him. I'll leave the last word to Smithy. It's a quote buried deep in his doctoral studies on the Jesus movement, and I can just imagine him in full flight in a packed marquee saying this. "Jesus is still a good conversation if you can get the religionist's hands off his throat long enough to let him speak for himself."
Just introduce yourself.
My name's Jenny. 45 years ago in Melbourne, I left the church of my family, which was quite strict Brethren, and had nowhere to put my burning faith until I found the Jesus Light and Powerhouse, which was a tiny little orange-painted house out in the far suburbs on the other side of town, which was where Smithy started what was to become a church, but was initially a meeting place for people who had nowhere to take their faith, or people of no faith had nowhere to find their faith. So back in the early days, when the squad was only about 2 or 3 years old, I had the privilege of riding with them. I never had a patch because my bike was never big enough. But I went with them to bike races and, looking back, places and mixing with people that, quite frankly, today would scare me. But in those days, we were fearless. I lived on one of the community houses, and I got to know John as my leader and my pastor and also my friend, and he baptized me in a backyard swimming pool. There was baptisms happening. I rode with the squad. I pillioned on the back of John's bike several times. And we went into schools to preach the gospel in a meaningful way that the children weren't hearing. And we went to these bike races, but mostly one of the biggest things was going into churches to try and rock their walls a bit and say, get out from behind these walls. John was the one who taught us what is possibly not so radical today, but do not stay in your pews, go and sit in the gutters. He also taught us that Jesus wasn't gentle and mild. He was, in the words I remember well, a fiery-eyed radical, and we were to go and be that too. Personally, he made me learn to challenge and to ask questions of my faith and of what people in authority were telling me. Spiritually, he challenged me to get out and be bold in my faith, and that it wasn't just about me. But most of all, John lived what he preached. Everything you heard here at Greenbelt, I can testify he lived it 24/7. And one story I'd like to tell you that was told of him: he was in the Philippines at an evangelist conference, and word came to him that there was a village on a rubbish dump that was going to be bulldozed. And he left that conference, and I'm getting goosebumps now thinking about it. He left that conference with members of his team and possibly Glenna, and went and stood in front of those bulldozers and said, "You will go over me first." And he stopped it. He was a prophet, and he lived it. I owe John a whole lot, because when I was in Melbourne, we used to hear that he went over to England to this thing called Greenbelt. And I moved to England in 1991. In 1992, a friend said, "Oh, your mate Smithy's coming to Greenbelt this year." And I thought, great, I'll go and catch up with John and Glenna, which I did. And I've been coming to Greenbelt ever since. So to paraphrase you, you thanked Greenbelt for bringing you John. I would like to thank John for bringing me Greenbelt. But just to finish, I just really remember every time he came over, I'd catch up with him. And back at Cheltenham, on what I believe was his last visit, sitting on the little stage at what was called Jerusalem, We sat and talked for about half an hour after one of his talks. And I just had this compulsion that I had to tell him what he had meant to me. And we chatted, and as I walked away, I felt, I have said goodbye. And it was. So goodbye, John, and thank you. And I'm really honoured to be part of this celebration of your life.
My name's Conchetta. And I've written a few words, I'm going to try and read them without crying, not because there's anything wrong with crying, but because it's not easy to talk and cry at the same time. When I saw there was to be a tribute session to John, an instantaneous and preconscious knot formed in my stomach. The unexpressible and the unexpressed that has been sitting inside me since he died. This man, whom my lost and struggling teenage self heard for the first time at Greenbelt in 1988. I sat in a tent much like this one, dazed, having recently run away from home and from a childhood of observing and experiencing horrific violence and violation. This fiery preacher, unlike anything I'd ever known in my Catholic upbringing, spoke of the man of sorrows acquainted with grief. About the closeness of God, not to those in the centre of the sparkling in crowd, but to those whose daily bread is powerlessness, voicelessness, and oppression. Oh, so familiar to me, having been raised in a fierce and brutal patriarchal family and cultural system. I went home clutching John Smith tapes, which I still possess, and I wore them out from repeat playing, feeling seen and feeling heard by this Aussie voice in my Surrey bedsit, where I sat as a runaway girl. Fast forward 10 years, my heart stopped when I was at a Christian artist conference in Holland and I literally bumped into John Smith. Face to face with this hero, I squeaked in a pathetic voice, "I've got a lot of your talks on tape and I listen to them all the time." Anyone who knew John can attest to the immense compassion of this man. Sorry. A compassion that was always ready to expand his heart and fit another human into it. And that's what he did with me. We became friends, and over the years I shared some of the pain of my upbringing with him, particularly of having a father who took so much from my life and gave so little to my soul except pain and a hole. And he said, albeit from afar, he wished to be like a loving father to me. "How can I do that for you?" he asked me after one green belt. "Remember my birthday?" I asked him. He promised, but he forgot. That was John. A big heart that often stumbled in the outworking. And if he can hear us right now, eulogizing about his legacy, I think he would be embarrassed if we only praised his brilliance, his passion, and compassion. He was at best away from all the crowds, one-to-one. That is where, at least to me, he was the most real, and he showed his own childlike vulnerability and his weakness. "I'm as common as my name," he told me once in such a moment. "I don't want the privilege of a contributor's pass. I want to get in line with everyone else," which he did here at Greenbelt. And like everyone else, like you and like me, he had a shadow self. A shadow self, which I also experienced and which caused me real pain at times. His shadow self and my own clashed and sparked on more than one occasion. The feisty Sicilian in me determined to challenge his stubborn blind spots. Note, I was feisty, he was stubborn. But each time this happened, we pushed through our ruptures in our relating, until we repaired imperfectly, because he still couldn't see what I was trying to tell him. And John, if you're listening, I'm carrying that conversation on with you at one point in the future until you see what I was trying to tell you. But just like Anthony said, the humility in him was real, because he knew when he'd gone too far. And I remember one green belt where one such occasion had happened and it caused me real hurt. The next day, a steward came up to me and said, "There's a guy called John Smith looking really sheepish and trying to find you." And he said he hadn't slept that night because he felt so bad and he couldn't rest until he'd seen me and looked me in the eye and apologized. That was the humility and the love. That was John. love and connection was always more important for him and for me. Yes, it would have been so much nicer if my hero of the Greenbelt talks and tapes had not been so flawed close up. It would have been a happier ending. But this is not my real experience of John. He is my faith hero with clay feet. John Smith, brilliant, stubborn, passionate, flawed, insecure, at times very self-absorbed, beautiful, loving, paradoxical John Smith. Most of all, he was always ready to stretch his heart a little further and tuck in another hurting people group or another hurting human. I know I remain tucked in his heart and he in mine.
There are two magnificent women, many magnificent women in John's life. One is Glenna, and she sent an email to Heather, which I'm going to read and paraphrase and send it to you. So, dear Greenbelt, what lovely memories I have of those festivals. So proud of my darling husband's contributions, an example of giving time to people instead of hanging around in the tents for the celebrities. She says to Heather, you managed him so well and wouldn't have accomplished so much without her support. I do long for writers and speakers on John's behalf to mention St. Martin's, which is the church in Melbourne where he was based. She in her mind has listed over 50 men and women who were launched from St. Martin's and are now in full-time working in churches and community groups across Australia. I think it's many more than 50, but she says 50. John empowered and gave opportunities to both men and women to preach and be on the road. He set the example of our church body, who patiently spent hours with marginalised and ate together and opened our home for 50 years. My screen has blipped. But she says next that her heart is torn in two, that she's well, she's still owning a home, and she's still living out the work that she and John established so many years ago. But she sends her love. Thank you.
Thanks, Rach. I'm Heather Kernow, who seems to be mentioned a couple of times. This is really unusual for me because I am always the organiser in the background, so don't normally stand here. But a couple of people asked if I'd say something about organising for John, which has to be said in a lifetime of organising is the most unique experience on the planet. The first time I organised for John was actually back in 1989 with when he was doing something with Martin Joseph. And so I've been organising things ever since. And I remember this first event should have just warned me what life would have been about the next 10, 20 years, was that organising, we didn't have God Squad then, we had CMA, I thought they might contact me, we put this event on for 500 people. And at some point, I got the message that he'd actually been sentenced to death, and which, as an organiser, had never happened before. And I remember thinking, what do I do now? Do I carry on selling tickets because he's been sentenced to death? Anyhow, obviously he survived that moment, life went on. And eventually then in April 91, I got on a plane and went out and worked with Steve Dury, John's manager at the time. I also then spent a year organizing down in Melbourne for John's organization. And when I then returned, they did talk about me staying out there more permanently, but I decided to come back. But when John came over here, organizing his time when he was over here touring, and it was something that this is pre-emails, texts, everything. It was fax, it was phone, and international travel times, always difficult. And the hours and hours and hours of frustration over days and weeks and months and pulling your hair out as to why you were doing it. And then John would be in, you would be with him for 20 minutes And then I remembered exactly why I did that, because just this unique human being, these extraordinary people in this room I have met because of working for him. And, yeah, we've toured, we went from Scotland down to Reading, it's been an extraordinary journey of meeting extraordinary people along the way and having to plan in a different way of getting him on stage, telling me it was about an hour before he needed to, because he'd always got caught in other conversations. It was an honour. I'll miss the man forever. But, yeah, thank you for just letting me say my piece.
My name is Andy Turner. I first heard about John on a housing estate in Stockport. I've been coming to Greenbelt since 84. Somehow I'd missed him. Probably was in the Rolling magazine with Pip. But it was a biker. His biker name was Biker, which was complicated. But anyway, he introduced me to a tape of John's. Cassette tapes and Smith feel like there's a whole thesis that could be written about that, the way that the tapes were kind of distributed around. So I got into John through cassettes and then found him at Greenbelt. And he was such a disruptor in terms of my life. We heard Martin Joseph earlier, who shifted massively. And there are lots of performers, artists, social workers, teachers, people in this venue here who've got stories about how hearing John and learning more about his life just disrupted and changed everything. One fellow who can't be here, who's written a book called Smith Happens, is an artist called Sammy Horner, a musician. He was in a band called The Electrics in the 80s, and then he bumped into John, I think it was at Spring Harvest, sometime in the 90s, and things changed. And anyway, he's written this book, beautiful picture on the front. You can find him on Facebook and get a hold of a copy. It's called Smith Happens, and it's like a kind of Darwin Awards of John's life. All kinds of extraordinary moments of cataclysm and catastrophe. And I thought I'd just read a little bit to you here. Is that okay? We've got time. Okay, so here it is. Sammy is going over to Oz to meet with John, and Sammy Horner, here it is, Smith Happens. They sat there in an artistically designed cedar box. Gold and red lettering drew me to it, and the words "fine Cuban cigars" told me that this was the gift for my pal Smith. Sure, they were a little expensive, but the duty-free price was helping me open my wallet. I handed over dollars and placed the box in my backpack. I knew Smithy would love them. The flight was 10 hours. It passed quickly. John was waiting for me in arrivals, and we drove the short journey back to his home in Baronia. His home in Baronia is another thesis. We could talk about that. An astonishing, absolutely packed with all kinds of... The man's a polymath. He would fill the place. When we got to his house, he told me that he had booked a cabin for us down near Bass Strait, and he was keen to take me fishing. I hate fishing. But I reasoned in my head, a cabin by the beach with my old mate, what can possibly go wrong? Jet lag was kicking in, and I knew we had a 2-hour drive to the cabin the next day. I hit the stacks so that I could get up a good sleep and then enjoy all the beautiful Victorian coastline that it had to offer me the following morning. Early next morning, I took a shower, had a hearty breakfast, which was just the ticket to help me feel normal again. As I shoveled down scrambled eggs, Smithy said, "Pack light. We're taking the Harley." The Australian sun was warm and welcoming. I was handed some leathers to wear on the bike, a helmet with a radio inside it, and some gloves. It seemed the perfect time to grab those fine Cuban cigars and give them to surprise my friend. His weather-beaten fuzzy figzog creased into a smile as he opened the box. He shrieked, "You beaut, mate!" or some other equally Australian cry of ecstasy. He took the cigars out and carefully put the box in one of his leather saddlebags, hanging on the hog. "These will be perfect for the ride, mate," he yelled as he kicked the Harley into life. I hopped on the back, and we both lit up our expensive treats. We headed out of town, and for the first time I could see why someone might want a Harley. The sun was warm on my face, the sky was blue, and other bikes waved as we sailed by. Then it happened. Suddenly, the bike began to shake. Just a little at first, and then it seemed as if John had lost total control of this powerful machine. He was holding on to one handle as he desperately seemed to be punching himself in the face. We screeched to a halt by the side of the busy road, and I breathed a sigh of relief that we hadn't hit a car or a truck as we wobbled to a complete standstill. I was calling out to John with a mild panic in my voice. I envisioned that a rock or a piece of metal had been thrown at him from a passing semi, or that he was having some kind of a seizure or heart attack. With his back to me, he hurriedly removed his smoking helmet and tossed it onto the ground beside as he continued to slap and beat at his own face. I felt that dread that starts in the gut and wrenches its way to that hard lump in the throat as John slowly turned his face to me. I was expecting multiple contortions, blood and gore, part of the nose gone or a missing eye. As his watery eyes met mine, a wave of relief came over me. No blood, no torn flesh. In fact, nothing looked that unusual except for a small pillar of black and grey smoke coming from his left nostril. If I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, I would never have believed it. Smith had happened. A red-hot ember from John's Cuban had been blown off by the hot Australian wind, but rather than blowing away or simply going out, it had lodged itself in Smithy's moustache and nose hair that lived upon his face, writes Sammy Horner. The helmet had acted like a set of billows or a wind tunnel, and using his nose hair as tinder, ignited the ember, setting his face on fire. We managed to extinguish the small blaze and stop the inferno raging like an Australian bushfire across his beard. It was a close call. Good sense seemed to enlighten us, and we continued our journey without our Cuban friends. The rest of the trip was uneventful. We found our cabin. It was a small wooden box with a dividing curtain. And it had no bathroom. Smith happens, Sammy Horner. John Smith, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you again. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for listening. Thank you to our amazing contributors. We've had tears. We've had laughter. It's great to finish in laughter. I just want to finish by saying, if you still want to come and write your own personal memories of John or your tribute to him, these will be collected together and sent to the family in Australia. And I think that will be a fitting tribute. So once again, thank you very much. Let's give it up for John Smith.
Thank you for listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. At Greenbelt, we make a space where artistry meets activism, where the political meets the practical, where the sacred meets the secular. We think we're somewhere to dream up a better world, to dance and debate, to pray and to party. Visit greenbelt.org.uk to browse and download other great thinking from our recorded catalogue. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.